Okay. David Halperin, thanks for coming to the Tulsa Historical Society. And today's date is Wednesday, March the 9th, 2005. My name is Chuck Ayers. And, you know, we got a little bit of a bio on you before, but it's kind of sketchy.
Fortunately, I brought one with me because I can't remember as well as I should either.
Prompt yourself on that. Okay. Did you grow up here? Were you born here?
No, I was born in Nashville, Tennessee.
Okay. Mm-hmm. When did you first come to Tulsa?
I came to Tulsa in, I believe it was 1971. It may have been, it was 1971. Mm-hmm. I'll double check that.
Well, that's okay. 71 is not important, but what did you come here for school or for opportunity?
No, I was well into my career by the time I came here. I had been in the advertising business from the time that I graduated from college in 1958 until I came here in 1971. And I came here at the time employed by an advertising firm here in Tulsa called Ad Inc., mm-hmm. Advertising Incorporated. Mm-hmm. It no longer is in existence, but that's how I got to Tulsa. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm assuming most of your career is surrounded by photography and the interest in photography.
I have a rather checkered past, you might say. No, I graduated from college with the intention of entering the advertising profession. And photography was something that I had pursued from the time I was a young child as a hobby. But I was always told growing up that that was not really what I wanted to do if I ever wanted to make a living in this world. And so I was steered in another direction instead. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I came here in 1971 I was put in a position where I had an opportunity to change over from the advertising business to a life that was devoted to the things that I was really enjoyed most, and photography and writing were my, you might say, my passions.
How old were you when you first became interested in photography?
In photography? Mm-hmm. Oh, I was a child, and I think it would be hard to say exactly when it was, but it was before my 13th birthday. I remember that specifically because I took a course in photography while I was in summer camp. Mm-hmm. And that was when I first learned to develop film and print and do that sort of thing, and on a much more rudimentary level than we do it today. I made my first serious photographs when I was 15 years old.
And what kind of camera were you using?
I was using at that time a camera called a Century Graphic, which was the smaller, the baby brother of what it was, the Crown Graphic that many people know today. It was a 4x5 press type camera. Mm-hmm. The camera that I used 2.25x3.25 film instead of 4x5 film.
Was it something like a Hasselblad? Or?
No. It was the kind that you it had a single lens. It had the big bellows. You put the film holders in the back, you know, and pulled out the dark slide to expose the film to the subject that was being transmitted through the lens. The press type. When one goes to the movies and sees the old press photographers with their flash bulbs popping in the faces of the celebrities, that was the kind of a camera it was.
So this thing wasn't necessarily portable.
It was portable. It was harder to hold than cameras, than a 35mm camera by a long shot. But the interesting thing is that the single lens 35mm camera, which is the camera that's used predominantly by most photographers today, whether they be amateurs or professionals, didn't come along until 1946. Mm-hmm. That camera wasn't, the first one was a camera called the Exacta. Mm-hmm. And until that time, the only 35mm cameras that were available for candid work were things like the Leica, mm-hmm. and other rangefinder type cameras. And then they developed the single lens reflex, which allowed the photographer to actually see through the same lens that captured the picture. Mm-hmm. And
so
that's what I broke my teeth on.
Sure. So after you came here, 1970 or whenever, and you worked for Ad Inc. for a while, when did you get really serious about photography, and what were you taking pictures of?
Well, I was already serious about photography, and I had used photography to an extent with the work that I'd done in the advertising business over the years. Although I'd served in every capacity in an advertising agency in which one could work. I'd been an account executive, and I'd been a writer, and I'd been a producer of television commercials, and I'd been a researcher. I'd done a lot of different things because I've always been a curious kind of a person. You know, I'm interested in a lot of different things, and so when I was in the advertising business, I tried out everything. But when I came here, what happened was I worked with the advertising agency for 7 months. And I came to the realization that my own philosophy and the philosophy of the business that I was in had simply polarized, and that I was finding myself in conflict too often with the things I was asked to do, and the assignments that I had, the challenges before me, or whatever you want to call it. And so I decided to take some time off and kind of get to know myself better and figure out what it was I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And I took a portfolio of my photographs and showed them to two local photographers for whom I had a great deal of respect. One of them was Bob Hawks, who retired just recently himself. The other one was a photographer by the name of Dennis Thompson, with whom I'd worked. He'd done some commercial work for me after I came here.
These are local photographers.
Uh-huh, local photographers. And the two of them encouraged me. And subsequently, I took this same portfolio of prints that I had made, and I took them to a woman who had a local gallery. Her name was Maxine Creamer. And she had a gallery called the Creamer Gallery, which was located down on 21st Street. And I knew of her because I'd worked with her husband, who was production manager at an advertising agency, the advertising agency where I'd worked, and we'd become friends.
What was your subject? So what was the photograph?
My subjects?
The subjects
has always been nature. Okay. A landscape and in nature.
So were they landscapes around the Tulsa area or around the country?
They were drawn broadly from around the country. At that particular time, I had not had the opportunities that subsequently had been presented to me. So I showed her my work, and she said, "How about we do a show of your work?" And so we did. And that was the springboard that really got me started. And I hung out my shingle as both a writer and a photographer. And I decided that I was going to take the marketing experience that I had had and use that to help me create a commercial photography business, but with a slightly different approach than most people. Most photographers were content to go out and make pictures for people and take their assignments and just do their bidding. My approach was to say, okay, I've got this real strong background in marketing. I have some expertise here that I can use to help determine what the best way to approach a problem is. And very often I would say to a client, you're not ready to take a picture yet. You're not ready for the photography. You're not ready to print the brochure you think you want. What we need to do is go back, and we have to develop a business plan and a strategy and figure out the whole thing and figure out where photography belongs. And by doing that, I was able to create a place for myself in the business community here. And I developed a really loyal clientele. The truth is that the very first client that I ever had was still with me the day I retired. Now, there were a lot of clients that were not, but I was proud of the fact that at least the very first one that I started out with was. But during the period of time when I was working commercially, I tried very hard to balance the commercial work that I did with the personal photography, which was fine art. And I also found time all during that period to teach as well as to practice photography. And it wasn't until 1984 that I got my really big break, and that was, I mean, I had several, my exhibition history goes back to 1974. But in 1984, I got a really big break when I was invited to serve as an artist in residence at Rocky Mountain National Park. Yeah. And that subsequently led to my working as an artist in residence 11 times with the National Park Service. Mm-hmm. That's the springboard to my success as a landscape and nature photographer.
How did that work?
Well, it was interesting. I had created a portfolio of my work, my black and white landscape photographs, mm-hmm. and I had become friends with a man who had been in charge of interpretation at the Wichita Mountains Wildlife Refuge in southwestern Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. I think it was about 1973. I made my first trip down there. Maybe it was earlier. I don't know, because I came here in 71. It may have been 72 or 73. And I made my first trip down there, and I met this gentleman. His name was Bill Sontag. And Bill and I became good friends. And I told him at the time that I was interested in writing an article that I wanted to submit to a magazine on the order of, of National Geographic or something like that. And I wanted to do it on the Wichitas. I was real fascinated with the natural environment there. And so he provided me access to a lot of information, and I went down there and made several trips and gathered photographs and studied the history and the geology and so forth. And then I prepared this article, and I sent a letter to National Geographic, and they were very kind to me. It's one thing to be turned down, but they turned me down in a very nice way. They said, the reason we can't take your article right now is that we have been to Oklahoma and we did something that included the Wichita Mountains within the last 5 years. I did not know that. And so they said, why don't you try some other publications? And one of them was suggested was the Sierra Club. And so I approached the Sierra Club Bulletin, and the Sierra Club Bulletin took the story, and that was my springboard into writing magazine articles and doing that sort of thing. And that relationship that I established with Bill Sontag at that time has lasted up until the present. Bill has went on from there, because that's with the refuge is managed by the Fish and Wildlife Service. He went to Washington, D.C. with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and then went into the National Park Service with the Department of the Interior after that, because the Fish and Wildlife Service is with the Department of Agriculture. He went to work with the National Park Service, and subsequently moved up the line and ultimately became a superintendent. So we maintained that relationship. Well, in 1984, he was in Denver. And at the time, he was working with all of the people who were in, I guess, in the interpretive roles within the National Park Service for the Denver region. Mm-hmm. And a man by the name of Glenn Kay, who was a chief interpreter at Rocky Mountain National Park, had just been given the assignment of developing an artist-in-residence program at Rocky Mountain National Park. This was a first. There had been artists in residence in national parks before, but not with a program like this one. What they did is they restored a cabin that was in the Moraine Park area of Rocky Mountain National Park, and using a grant from the University of Kansas. This was a cabin that had been used by William Allen White, the famed journalist and one-time editor of the Emporia, Kansas Gazette. He was twice Pulitzer Prize winner. He used to go there. For 30 years, he went there and worked in the summer times and did his significant writing and wrote many books and articles. But they restored this cabin, which had been sitting there going to pieces since the man died. And made it a residence so that artists in residence could come and work in the park and interpret it. And then they said, okay, this is what we'll do. We'll develop this program. We'll invite artists here to spend a period of time. And they will, through their work, interpret the park in a manner that we can share with our visitors and for educational purposes, interpretive purposes.
Let me ask you a question, and we'll continue. Because I've seen, you know, various parks we went to, and there'll always be, well, not always, but mostly be an interpreter center. So this is what this is for the various artists and residents to display, you know, what they're... You know,
no, not to display. This was a unique opportunity to create a program where artists would be invited to come and work in the park and then contribute a portion of what they created to the park so that it could be used for educational interpretive purposes. By the same token, it gave the individual artists a chance to really develop their own portfolios and to move in perhaps in new directions. And so Glenn went to see Bill at the time and said, I would like to invite a photographer. And the only person who had used the cabin up until then was the head of the journalism department at the University of Kansas, because they had given the original funds to restore the cabin. And so Bill had his portfolio of my work and said, well, here's somebody that I would like you, whose work I'd like you to see. He showed him the portfolio. He turned around immediately and called me and said, will you come and work here? Well, I thought it was, you know, this, I thought somebody was playing a joke on me. It was a dream come true. And I took maybe 3 milliseconds to answer the question and say, yes, I'll be there. But I could only go for a week that year. And the reason for that was I'd just gotten back from a trip that I took to Greece, where I was a photographic escort for a tour with the challenge of helping make sure all the visitors in our group got the good pictures. So anyway, let me finish this thought. And so I took the position. I went there, and I worked really hard during that 1 week because I wanted to get invited back. And it turns out I produced enough of a portfolio in that 1 week's time, so they invited me back the next year, and they invited me back the next year. And they were going to invite me back for the fourth year. They did invite me back during the winter time. When I didn't get to use the cabin because the cabin's not winterized, but I did work there 4 times, and then from that I used that as the springboard. I've used that word often enough, but I did. It was a springboard of sorts to move off and work in other parks, and so that's how I got involved in the artist in residence program. And it's a question of being at the right place at the right time. It's a lucky break, is what it was.
Yeah. What are you looking for when you compose a picture? What do you think you're finding that maybe some people are not?
Well, I hope I'm finding something that, I don't know that I'm finding something that other people are not, but I'm finding something that I can express in a manner that, reflects my unique vision, or my special way of looking at the world. You know, the work that I'm known for here, for example, which is the photography in the book Tulsa Art Deco, is of a different nature entirely. When I got involved in that, it was because I had an interest in architecture, among other things. As like I said, I'm interested in a lot of things. And I was just determined when they said they were looking for a photographer to do this, I was just determined I was going to do it. And so when the Junior League was interviewing photographers, I said, I really want to do this, you know. And I was fortunate enough to get the job. But the approach, the one thing that's common across all the photography that I've tried to do over the years is I've always tried to do the best quality work I could do with any subject, regardless of what the subject was. And I've tried to approach everything with the same attitude that I approach my fine art with. In other words, I'm always trying to look for a way I'm trying to see it in a way that expresses my own vision whenever I'm permitted to do that. And I'm trying to put out the work with a quality of craftsmanship and a technical excellence in everything, regardless of what it is. Nothing bothers me more than somebody says, oh, all you need to do is a quick snapshot. There's no such thing in my mind as a quick snapshot. You know, it all requires a certain amount of thought, and people never, when you do something quick and dirty, people never remember that was what you were told to do or that was the challenge at the moment. All they know, if they don't like it later, you get blamed for everything that's wrong with it. If you want to be known for something, and if you want to build a reputation, you have to be conscious of the need to do it the best you can do it, no matter what
was
it is.
Was it Ansel Adams, the one that said he only takes one picture of each subject?
No, he didn't do that.
It was someone like that. He said, it only takes one picture, and it better be good, you know? I don't know.
Well, now, there have been, I do know photographers who have the attitude that where they only expose one sheet of film. Mm-hmm. You know, when they look at something, they expose one sheet of film, and that is either it or it's not it. Mm-hmm. I've never done that because I've always believed in Murphy's Law.
Yeah, is writing as big a part in your photography career as photography itself, or
writing at first was the dominant thing. I was doing more writing than I was photography, but it's turned around the other way now. Most of the writing I do now is personal. It's about subjects that
it's
I care about,
or it's separate it's, from.
Yeah, and I'm a journal keeper. Mm-hmm. I love to put down my thoughts on paper, because I think it helps me understand the whole creative process better. I encourage my students to do the same thing. I'm not so much interested in the technical aspects. You know, in books for years,
all strictly nonfiction.
Oh yeah,
type writing.
I've done some writing of fiction, but it's you know, I'm not good at that, quite frankly. You know, it's I guess it's that I'm so preoccupied with the detail. You know, I'll give you an example. Talking about preoccupation with detail, when I was a student in my high school years, I tried to be a painter. Mm-hmm. My problem with being a painter is I never knew when to quit. I'd get to a point and I would never let it go. And as a result, I would work everything to death. So I became as a photographer, I didn't have that problem. I mean, because you could only take it so far, and reality took over and it told you when to quit. But when you were painting, for example, one of the great things about the fine watercolorists is that they know what to leave out. I look at the work, the oil paintings of Moran, and it's amazing. When you look at his work, you see such incredible detail in your mind, and yet it's incredible how much of the detail is not in the painting. Mm-hmm. It feels like it's there, but it's not. I never had that ability. Mm-hmm. So in the photograph, which records all the detail, I think I found the greater satisfaction.
What was in the topography or geology in the Wichita Mountains that fascinated you?
It was the geometry and the rocks. It's a fascinating terrain. It's among it's one of the oldest mountain ranges in the continental United States, and its history dates back 600 million years.
Was it from a distance or close up or both?
Both. But, you know, from a distance, you immediately recognize it as something that kind of resembles, in a way, an African veldt in places, you know. Mm. But when you get up close to it, you know, you have these wonderful granite boulders, and this tremendous contrast of geometric shapes and the wonderful texture of the granite. Mm-hmm. So I did a lot of pictures down there, and I don't know that I thought about it so much at the time when I started doing it, but the geometry of it is what still fascinates me when I go back and look at the pictures today. I don't always approach every subject the same, but I go and I try to find out, you know, what is it about the individual subject that really moves me, and what is it that I think is going to move people who are going to look at this picture? Because what I'm trying to do ultimately is to say, you know, these are wonderful places. This is a wonderful natural environment we have. There's a need to protect it and conserve it.
Mm-hmm. And
I want other people to embrace that philosophy. And if you're going to do it, you've got to find out what is it that will appeal to these people and make them think that way too.
What did you try to include in your writings about them?
Like I said, I was going to say something about that a minute ago, is that I don't like to get into the technical aspects, the f-stops, the shutter speeds, and all that sort of thing, because, you know, that information really isn't relevant. The only thing it's relevant to is if somebody's standing right next to me at the time and says, what f-stop and shutter speed are you using? It might be helpful to them then. But, you know, the light's different today than it's going to be tomorrow, and So you just, but what you want to know is, what was going through my mind at the moment that I took that picture? Mm-hmm. What was it that moved me to take that? I have a little anecdote I'll share with you. Mm-hmm. Several years ago, when I was working as an artist in residence at Bryce Canyon National Park, I was at a place along the road that goes through the park north to south, south to north. And it wasn't a real turnout, but it was kind of a wide spot in the road, and I had parked my car off the roadside, and I had my camera set up, and it was looking out into the canyon. And I'm under my big focusing cloth and looking out. And all of a sudden, I hear a car come screeching up to a stop behind me. And this woman gets out of this van and runs over to see what I'm doing. Because, you know, unfortunately, you got a big camera like that, you attract attention. And she looks at what I'm photographing and then turns around and hollers back to her husband in the car, "There's nothing over here."
Like, are there whales out there?
Yeah, so I entitled the picture, "Nothing Over Here."
Are they looking for a black bear?
I don't know what they were looking for, but it's kind of fascinating. You know, people see things in different ways.
Right, yeah.
But when I, well, for example, I have worked at, as I told you, Rocky Mountain National Park, Bryce Canyon National Park, mm-hmm. Black Canyon of the Gunnison, Glacier National Park, and Acadia. With the exception of Acadia, I've worked at every other location at least twice. Mm-hmm. Okay, and each one of those places is unique in its own way. Mm-hmm. And for example, the Black Canyon of the Gunnison, they asked me where I wanted to go, and I said, "I want to go to the Black Canyon of the Gunnison." Well, a year I asked them if they'd send me there. They said, no, we want you to go here first. And they sent me to Glacier, and then they sent me to Bryce. And they finally let me go to the Black Canyon. They said, "Why do you want to go to the Black Canyon?" I mean, anybody who's ever been there knows it's aptly named. It's a very narrow gorge, and it's very deep, and it's rugged, and it's tough to work there. And I said, "The reason I want to go there is because I can't imagine a subject harder to photograph than the Black Canyon of the Gunnison. I wanted to try it." They sent me to Bryce Canyon because I was working predominantly in black and white, and they wanted to see what I would do in black and white with the subject that everybody else photographed in color. And I did that. I went to Glacier because it's a great big place and virtually impossible to cover in a lifetime. but I was fascinated with it. I had visited before, and it's a wonderful wildflower garden if you go there in the summertime anyway.
Can we talk about the Art Deco architecture downtown?
Sure.
What got you interested in that, and what did you see there that
I wanted
other people to see?
Basically, I was interested in architecture, and if somebody was doing a book on architecture here in Tulsa, I just felt like I needed to be the one to photograph it. Not that there weren't other very competent architectural photographers here. There are. But I just wanted to do it. And I didn't have a lot of say about what I photographed, and not too much say in how I photographed it either, because this was a project of the Junior League of Tulsa. And the people who were putting that book together had very specific notions, okay? I'm not saying they were wrong or they were right. Obviously, they must have been right about some things because the book won an awful lot of awards. But I wanted to do it to the extent that I could. I mean, when I went out to photograph something, they would say, "I want a photograph of that lantern on the front of, on the step at Webster High School. I want a photograph of the front of the Tulsa Fire Alarm Building. I want a picture of this house from this angle." And, you know, there were some occasions when I would say to them, "I think the angle that you picked is the wrong angle. Would you let me try it from this angle?" I'd have to be candid with you and tell you that there were times when they said, "I don't care what you think, you will photograph it the way we want it photographed." So very often what I did is I photographed it my way, and I photographed it their way, and then on occasion I would show them the two photographs together, and on more than one occasion they said you were right, you know, so that did work. But what I tried to do was interpret these things as I thought the architects would want them interpreted.
What is indicative of Art Deco here in Tulsa, and how does it compare to other cities with the Art Deco architecture?
Well, Art Deco is the same around the world, but I think the one thing that's interesting about Tulsa's Art Deco is that the style of Art Deco in many other cities was blended into existing architectural styles because the cities were older and already had a lot of structures of their own that were distinctive. I mean, when you go to New York, it's a classic example.
What period are we talking about?
We're talking about the 30s and up into the early 40s. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the title of the book, if the title of the book is longer than just Tulsa Art Deco, mm-hmm. I think I've got that written down here. It's called Tulsa Art Deco, an architectural era, and it's 19 something to 1940 something. I think I would know that. When we published the second edition of the book, we didn't use that subtitle. It's in 1925 to 1942 is the era that we covered originally, okay? And the whole thing springs from an exhibition that was held in Paris, France. And it was a new style of architecture that, and I'm not the most qualified to talk about it. I know lots of architects and historical experts that are much better qualified than I. But there were different periods of Art Deco, but it still emphasized the decorative element, and the thing that people remember most about, I think, Art Deco these days, because there's so much of it still extant, are the really streamlined looking buildings. And we have a number of homes in Tulsa that were built in that manner. There were gas stations that were built in that manner. We had public buildings that were built that way. If you go to Miami, Florida, you still see so many of those old, minimalist looking kind of residential structures. Photographing it here in Tulsa, I came to realize that Tulsa's Art Deco was different from the Art Deco that I saw elsewhere, because if you go to a city like New York and you see the Art Deco there, you realize that not only did they embrace the elements of Art Deco, but they incorporated them along with existing styles of architecture that had been there for many years beforehand. Mm-hmm. Tulsa was a brand new city. Mm-hmm. And so when Tulsa, when they went out and they did something, they said, oh, this is brash, this is new, this is something that we can embrace and we can make it our own. And so they did that. And they created buildings that were pure Art Deco. You know, it didn't have any elements of anything else in it.
When you were photographing, were you trying to get the entire structure, or were you trying to get something close in that is indicative of that particular building, or indicative of just Art Deco? Or?
Sometimes it was the whole building. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it was...
What did you have to do to get the whole building in there?
Well, it depended on the building. I mean, there's some buildings you just couldn't do that with.
Across the street or up on top of other buildings?
There were times I worked from the roofs of adjacent buildings. Mm-hmm. There were times I worked, from an appropriate distance or with a wide-angle lens that would take it all in. Mm-hmm. And there were times when it wasn't necessary to photograph the whole building. For example, you remember the old warehouse market building? Well, the element that was important to the old warehouse market building was the tower. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if you got the tower, you captured the essence of the building. And so mm-hmm. I photographed that in lots of details of it. Mm-hmm. The one building that I think that I devoted the most time to, and maybe not at the time I did the book, is the Boston Avenue Methodist Church. Mm-hmm. Not only did I photograph it for the Art Deco book, but I subsequently came back and I had a love affair with the church. And for a period of 9 years, I went over there on my own time and photograph that building and all its spaces and all its decorative elements, everything about it. And of course, the church ultimately published a book called More Than Just a Building.
How many pictures do you think you actually took of that one?
Of that one? Oh, I don't know. I don't.
Like in the hundreds or?
No, it's actually
or
if you
dozens or.
It's not more than a more than it's not. Maybe it's 100. Maybe it's a few more. You know, it's not that there are that many of them. You go and you try to capture an element for example, the sanctuary. You can photograph the sanctuary from a lot of different directions, and I photographed it from every direction that to me made sense. So maybe I've got 8 or 10 views of the sanctuary, out of which we have used maybe 3. And there are other places, like for example, I had to photograph the little chapel that's in the top of the tower. Mm-hmm. And it was all I could do to find one angle there that I could even capture the essence of that space with. There's one, of course, they've continued to remodel the building, and there's one element I still haven't photographed.
But, let's talk about the Sherwin Miller Museum, or Art Museum, I guess it is, and how you got involved in that. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I was invited to serve on the board of the museum in 1980. I didn't know exactly why, but I guess it was because I had an interest in art.